by Dan McKinnon. Dan McKinnon is the Ralph Waldo Emerson - Unitarian Universalist Association senior lecturer at Harvard Divinity School, and his concerns are largely with 19th century liberal religious history. And this book really talks about kind of the radical thread that runs through liberal religion from the earliest days, and I want to share a little bit of a story of a man named Charles Sheldon. In 1889, 3 years out of Andover Seminary, he was called to launch a new congregation in the growing neighborhood of Topeka. The son and nephew of frontier ministers, Sheldon brought a familiarity with the Great Plains, a reforming sensibility, and an extroverted pastoral style. Central Congregational Church was an offshoot of a congregation founded by abolitionists, and it was close to Topeka's largest African-American neighborhood. Social idealism was sufficiently strong that Sheldon felt safe to preach a Christ for the common people, whose religion does not consist alone in cushioned seats and comfortable settings, but a Christ who bids us all to recognize the brotherhood of the race, who bids throw open this room to all. Sheldon was radicalized by his first winter in Topeka, when a weak agricultural economy threw hundreds out of work during unusually cold weather. Unable to secure employment for a man who had knocked on his door, Sheldon felt compelled to experience the man's plight for himself. Walking from coal yards to flouring mills and elevators and shoe shops in his oldest clothes, Sheldon found no work and plenty of other disappointed job seekers. As he entered imaginatively into his experiment, Sheldon felt such a hunger for work that he volunteered to shovel railroad tracks for free. "Just to be in the company of human beings who are working," he mused, added to my self-respect, which I had been losing for 4 days and a half, because no one in the wide world needed me. Sheldon's next step was to spend 1 week with each of several occupational or demographic groups. After encountering streetcar operators and college students, he turned to the black community of Tennessee Town. This encounter swelled to 3 weeks as he met job seekers, students, and community leaders. He was pleased to learn that a local restaurant did not segregate, but chagrined that a new black friend could not join the Young Men's Christian Association. Time with other groups solidified Sheldon's sense of the horrible blunder and stupidity of our whole industrial system that does not work according to any well-established plan of a brotherhood of men. Soon Sheldon incorporated his congregation into participant observation, asking the youth to research social problems, and then incorporating their findings into his sermons. He founded one kindergarten at his church building and another in Tennessee Town, and attracted a growing, somewhat racially integrated congregation. The story then goes on to say that the place where Sheldon had his greatest impact was in the serialization of one of his novels. And his novel, I'm going to say it was called In His Steps, published first in 1897, he fictionalized an account of the experience, his experience, and posited from that what would it be like for Jesus to be out there walking and not getting a job? What would it be like for any of us to get into that place? And what's interesting is he actually coined the phrase, "What would Jesus do?" which was not about kind of a suburban teenage thing with wearing a wristband and imagining that Jesus would do exactly what I wanted to do, but actually, how would Jesus turn the tables? How would Jesus walk into the temple and upset everything? because the system that Jesus might have found in his steps in Topeka in the 1890s was so unjust, unfair, impossible. Dan McKinnon, in his book Prophetic Encounters, Religion and the American Radical Tradition, essentially says that a religious radical tradition has existed in our country from the beginning. That when you declare that the basis for your being together is to give people an opportunity for life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, that that's a radical agenda. That from day one, this notion of being a country where people have an opportunity to pursue life, to pursue it in freedom, and to find happiness, or at least to pursue happiness, that that requires that we have a way of being with one another that is about the common good, is about the opportunities that are presented for one another and with one another, so that we all may find some benefit in this democratic experiment of being with one another. It's interesting that the story is told from a religious perspective, because we often separate very easily religion from politics. We often throw religion into the kind of conservative end of things and politics into a place of upending and undoing. And part of that is because religion sometimes says it's about bringing everyone together, and politics is often about separating people apart. But what McKinnon asks us to think back to is the Second Great Awakening, religious revival happening everywhere, and the encouragement of the leaders of that revival was to go and create the authentic church, to go out and to redo the church, to be a church that speaks to the heart and awakens our passion, and in every place you start a church, start an abolition society. So from day one of that Second Great Awakening, this notion of revival was not just about my heart. This notion of revival was not about my future in heaven or some other place. That the notion was about being in a place where we respond to love that's active and passionate by ourselves being active and passionate in the pursuit of social good. You might know also that after the Second Great Awakening whipped through, and we talk about Western Massachusetts as the burned, Western New York as the burned over district, a place where revival after revival had gone through, and they came to a place when revivalists would go through and they were getting no traction. Nobody was hearing it because they'd all heard it before. And this became the place of the experiment of the great utopian communities. This also became the place where Seventh-day Adventism emerged and where Mormonism came out. New religion started to spring. Spiritualism began to come out of that area. But the notion that beyond a large, compelling message about my heart being moved, might be the possibility of a large, compelling message about us being a community with one another, and a community with one another that in its very being critiques the way things already are. In the utopian experiments, and whether we're talking about Brook Farm or Fruitlands or the Oneida community or many others, there were three great concerns that kind of get stated and recapitulated, and they become part of this story of a radical tradition within American religion. One of them is about women's equality. A number of these communities, women were chief personalities behind the founding of the community. The abolition of slavery had long been part of the story of this new religious awakening that was particular to this country. And then notions of economic justice. And you can see that in a time when industry is moving from small craft production to the beginnings of factory production, that there's a concern with not losing humanity, of wanting to continue to be a place where the craftsman and the product of their labor, the craftsperson and the product of her labor, is not alienated from the person by machinery and by an economic system, but actually continues to be in the control of the producer, so that when the producer sells that onto the market, that he or she is not alienated from the fruit of their labor. So, women's equality, the abolition of slavery, and economic justice are three strands of this radical tradition. And how people become countercultural, become cultural critical, become radical, is often taking place in three ways. One is that our experience of everyday living and our dissatisfaction with it becomes a thing that we identify with. I identify as a gay man. As a gay man, I start to meet other people who identify as gay men. And we have a particular experience in the world that allows us to critique the larger world. We become radicalized as part of our identity. Or the American radical tradition is spurred by certain charismatic personalities. You meet Frederick Douglass, you hear him speak, and your life has changed. Susan B. Anthony speaks and speaks to you in a particular way that changes who you are. And so the encounter of an individual with an individual begins to allow one to see the world a different way. Frederick Douglass is talking about his experience as a black man. I'm not a black man, so his black man-ness is not touching my identity. But his experience of oppression and my desire to create systems of justice allow me to be changed by his witness. And then finally, the American radical tradition gets perpetuated by collective encounter. And so, if you are one of hundreds and thousands and millions of immigrants coming to this country, you begin to bring to your experience of coming here, there's a disjoint between the promise you were given when you got that thing that said that the streets were paved with gold, and you show up and you see what the streets are really paved with, that your collective consciousness says there's something very out of kilter here, and so we need a fraternal organization to be with one another. We need a sororital association that will give us strength and power. We need a union to allow us to deal with what it means to be here. In Unitarianism and Universalism, the American radical tradition has existed and has been perpetuated, and it's interesting to hear that it's not like we had congregations who are actually radical congregations. We have lots of experiences where in this kind of big middle-class congregation, which is what our Unitarian and Universalist congregations largely were, that there might be a very middle-of-the-road minister who is speaking about our values, and somehow somebody in the room is touched and goes on to invent something that critiques the society. So there's some places where some of our ministers were kind of radical. So when John Haynes Holmes at the Community Church of New York, or Church of the Messiah Unitarian, that became Community Church Unidentified, unrelated, free and to itself, that when he was part of that movement, he founded the ACLU. He founded the NAACP. I mean, there were places where ministers were actually themselves radical, although their congregations might be complex and not all of one mind. You might have places where ministers were actually more conservative than their people. In the case of William Ellery Channing, we call him the reluctant radical. Slow to come to some political positions, including abolition. And yet he had a congregation that included big abolitionists among them, because they heard in his message a call for them to be active in a particular way. In this congregation, it was under Reverend Weld in the 1890s that very important ministry here, kind of conservative ministry, the ministry that led to the installation of this Jesus picture. You know, back in the day, we didn't have anything that identified a particular religion in this place. It was big, open, and the big, wide-open space was, in its classic grandeur, was the message. Well, we changed our minds in the 1890s, made the place a little smaller, made it a little more traditional, made the pulpit look more like our Episcopalian friends, put Jesus up there. Relatively conservative ministry, and yet Mary Ellen Richmond, in this place, hears a call not just to do charity, not just to do charity, but to go out and do scientific charity, I believe that's what she called it, which was to establish social work as a profession, to say that the poor should not be dealt with because some of us have the capacity, out of our goodness, to deliver something, but that all of us have a responsibility for the uplifting, the upbuilding of the poor, of the homeless, of those who are not included. Our Unitarian Universalist legislative ministry here in Maryland is, I'm going to say, not a radical institution, but it's an institution that asks us to engage in key questions about who we are with one another, and to do it faithfully and consistently and with a vision of our faith over time. I'm thinking of some of the areas of concern that we've lifted up. You know, healthcare is an issue that we've been thinking about. We've been promoting the fullest access to healthcare that we can deliver, including the success we had in the law about getting alcohol taxes to be directed toward healthcare resources. We've been about the promotion of a single-payer healthcare system in Maryland. It hasn't won. We haven't gotten there yet. And right now, with changes in healthcare because of the federal level, we're going to continue to consider what is the right thing for us to be promoting at this time. I bet Dick Humphrey has an idea about that, and I bet he'll even tell us from time to time. The death penalty is something we've been working on, that is, working against for a long time. Thank you, Laurel, for your poem. As a partner of the Maryland Citizens Against State Executions, we were pleased with the limitations on the death penalty that were put in the previous legislative session, and we were happy to hear that Governor O'Malley's put the call to eliminate entirely the death penalty onto the top of his agenda. We expect to be working with him about that. We think that climate change is an issue we need to think about, and more than think about, we need to act about. And so, because we believe that climate change is caused, at least in part, by human activity, we know that if we can find ways to reduce the human impact on the environment that leads to global warming, we will be doing something good for all of us. A specific step toward reducing our dependence on fossil fuels for power is to begin large-scale wind farming off of our coast, and so we in the UU Legislative Ministry have continued to back legislation that would result in the state investing in offshore wind. And then we talk about LGBTQ issues. This is a particularly rich and diverse area of interest. I love that on the UU Legislative Ministry website it just says LGBTQ issues, assuming that we all know what that is. And I guess maybe we do. But as a reflection of our long-term welcome of gay and lesbian, bisexual, queer, and questioning people and transgender people in the life and leadership of our congregations, we have quite a reputation among communities of faith for our BGLTQ advocacy. In recent years, this has meant supporting same-sex marriage, a struggle we helped to win. And in the current legislative session, this now means supporting the Fairness for All Marylanders bill, introduced last Tuesday by Senators Richard Maddaleno and Jamie Raskin, a bill which protects the gender identity and presentation of all Marylanders, including transgender people. I want to speak for just a moment about this bill and perhaps a distant historical precedent that emerged in the American radical tradition that showed that the tradition is not an organic union with all of its members marching lockstep with one another, but rather the American radical tradition is kind of a trend, kind of a traveling together of people, kind of a tendency of interests and perspectives that come together and sometimes diverge. Now, I don't know if you know that your minister is sometimes a real jerk. It's true, a decade ago or so, I was talking with a young man who was thinking about entering the Unitarian Universalist ministry when I asked him about his sense of call to the UU ministry. He began, as a member of the LGBTQ community, and I stopped him and I said, "Holy crap! Where did you find that? I've been looking for the LGBTQ community for a long time. I can't find it anywhere." And he knew that I was being a jerk and said, "Well, as a member of the gay and lesbian community." And I said, "Really? Is that possible? I mean, I have lesbian separatist friends. I have elitist gay men who travel four times a year. I mean, I don't know that they experience themselves as a community at all. Although they might vote together from time to time or whatever." And so finally he said, "As a middle-aged gay man," and talked about his life. And then we had a chance to talk about whether or not he really might have a call to the Unitarian Universalist ministry. That LGBTQ label described in an unhelpful way a unity that didn't really exist and could not be relied on to automatically deliver. In the 19th century, after the Civil War, our nation amended its constitution to abolish slavery, to grant equal protections to all persons, and to grant voting rights to people in spite of race, color, and previous condition of servitude. You notice it doesn't say a darn thing about gender or sex. So indeed, when the 15th Amendment was passed, the vote was extended to black men, but the vote was not extended to women. That was 1870, and it wouldn't be until 1920, 50 years later, that women would have the right to vote at the federal level. There were, well, any illusion that the American radical tradition gave equal value to all the participants in the tradition is easily revealed to be untrue by a clear retelling of history. Women were asked to allow the black men to get the vote and not to be obstructionist in demanding their own right to vote at the same time. And that's what happened in history. Women were asked to allow black men to become full participants in our political process and to themselves wait for their own rights. My colleague, who began by relying on this one community, the LGBTQ community that I didn't think really existed, spoke as if there were one unified community where each of us stood up for the rights and concerns for all of us. But this isn't true. Among the many gay men I know and love, confusion about gender identity and presentation is immense. Acceptance of transgender people is limited. My friends and I love a good drag show. But when you come to ask questions about transgender stuff, sometimes we think you're just talking about sex workers who are trying to save up their money to get their operations. My a dear lesbian friend once bemoaned the decision of a friend to come out as a trans man, in his case, a man who had been living in a woman's body, and that was clearly what that trans presentation meant. And to my dear lesbian friend, this was just a desire to put on male privilege and an unwillingness to accept a life as a quite fine lesbian. Thank you. No. Transgender people are misunderstood and mistrusted and sometimes frightening. Gender presentation itself is misunderstood and mistrusted, sometimes frightening. We talk about the Christmas attack on the man for being a gay man. He wasn't attacked because he was gay. He was attacked because he was effeminate. He was attacked because he was a gender violator, I believe. And yes, it was a hate crime. But there are transgender people among us seeking simply to find life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. It might be easy for us to imagine that the forces that successfully fought for marriage equality will quickly and effectively rally around the Fairness for All bill. But I think that that would be misguided. Those of us who experience sexual orientation difference, gay, lesbian, bisexual oppression, do not immediately understand nor side with people who experience gender difference and gender oppression. And so we need to have an encounter, a prophetic encounter perhaps, with people who know what it is to be transgender, to be non-conforming in their gender presentation. Meg Parker sent this email. It says, "The Fairness for All Marylanders Act of 2013 is important to me because many of the people that I love would benefit from this law being passed." Meg has had an encounter which has allowed her to step into a new place. Like the majority of people, I don't give a lot of thought to the subject of gender. My gender and preferred presentation are straightforward and happen to conform to social norms. She says, and you can decide whether this is true or not, "I'm a girly girl who was pronounced female at birth and have always lived comfortably within that label. If you are like me, there is rarely a reason to think about gender. You can glide into public restrooms at ease. If you are unfortunate enough to be harassed or stared at in public, it doesn't cross your mind that it might be because of your gender presentation. You don't wonder if you are passing. You know that you have the basic rights that prevent you from losing your home and your job, regardless of your employer's personal prejudices. If you are like me, you assume that everyone has these same rights. You assume that all of your loved ones are covered under the laws that cover you, that keep you safe, that let you walk down the street knowing that if you are to be harassed, if you are to be the victim of a crime, the law is on your side. The Fairness for All Marylanders Act is not a transgender or transsexual bill. It is what it claims to be, a piece of legislation that covers all Marylanders. It is important to me as a person who is fully protected under Maryland law to give a hand to my friends and loved ones who are not currently protected. Let's work together to plug this odd little archaic hole in the law and make sure that all Marylanders have equal rights and protections." Our congregation is thinking about this question. Our congregation is in a place of wanting to get some consciousness raising, and that this is going to happen because of our encounter with people who are able to tell their stories, people who are able to open our eyes to the ways that we operate, the ways that we operate habitually, when by our eyes being opened we might act intentionally, often counterculturally. This beautiful congregation that holds us and that we comprise includes a healthy acknowledgement of being a countercultural community. We don't have one mind about the culture we inhabit. Indeed, this highly educated, middle-class religious culture we find in these four walls, for some of us, just feels like home. We deserve to be here. This is who we are. This is how we are in the world. For others, this place is a refuge that some of us have come to seek freedom from some other place. And for some of us, this is a place where we've immigrated joyfully, happily. Maybe the highly educated middle class things are not exactly how we were brought up, but this is a place where we come to treasure the richness of this place, the openness of hearts and minds, the inquiry that many of us have, and the willingness that our hearts can be moved to the point that some of us took clothing face to face to bring to people on the streets on the coldest days in the past week. This is a magnificent place for us to come to be, and also to be countercultural, to be culture critical. We've come into this place from places with greater clarity about what identifies us as a community, and from places where identities are confused. And in this home, we find a place to look for life, to experience liberty, to pursue happiness, all essential parts of what it means to be part of this country. And when we encounter unfairness that we can address, we are not unwilling to embrace causes and to build our prophetic imagination, that we might combine our strength with other people's strength for the upbuilding of character and the growth of our own moral and ethical resources and relationships. This ties us in to the great democratic tradition, the great tradition of moving from the world as we see it to the world that our faith calls us to build. This is about the salvation of all of us as individuals and of us as a society. As social gospeler Walter Rauschenbusch said, there are two great entities in human life. The human soul, you each have one. The human race, that's who we are. And a religion that includes a radical critique is about the work of saving both. May it be. May it be. Amen.